Hello, this is Steve Burei, president of Discovery Institute. I want to take a moment to thank all of the listeners of the ID the Future podcast and all of our faithful supporters. Each year, the Center for Science and Culture produces over 100 original ID the Future broadcasts covering a wide range of subjects, including interviews with scientists and scholars like Michael Behe, author of Darwin's Black Box, David Berlinski, author of The Devil's Delusion, science historian Michael Flannery, molecular biologist Doug Axe, and many more. If you enjoy the news and information you get regularly on the ID the Future podcast, I would encourage you to take just a few moments and go to www.idthefuture.com and click on the yellow donate button at the top of the page. Your tax-deductible donation will allow us to keep producing this podcast. Again, please go to www.idthefuture.com and click on the yellow donate button. Thank you for your support, and now on with the show.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. In this episode, we'll talk with Dr. Jay Richards, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute and the director of the Center on Wealth, Poverty, and Morality, as well as the co-author of Indivisible, Restoring Faith, Family, and Freedom Before It's Too Late. In this podcast, we'll discuss Dr. Richards' contribution to the book The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. Why are the existence of human beliefs a problem for strict Darwinian evolution, and how did Lewis argue that beliefs are not likely to have come from natural selection?
Well, it's funny because Lewis picks up on an argument in his book Miracles and some other places that Darwin himself had suggested. Darwin and the Origin of Species, it's often called Darwin's Doubt. He worries, he says, you know, what does it mean if our minds and our thoughts come from the thoughts of apes or monkeys, if they have thoughts at all? And his point was that if everything's a result of a purely purposeless and blind process, so all of our thoughts are just sort of chemical reactions, those things that we believe about other people or about science or whatever, they're all just really chemical reactions that don't have any connection to truth or propositions, it's very unlikely that they connect with reality. And so if the Darwinian claim of natural selection and random variation, purely material processes, is true, it's unlikely that we would have trustworthy reason. And the irony of this is what philosophers call this a self-refuting argument, because the materialist often claims that his views are based on evidence and science and reason, and yet if his position is right as a materialist, we have good reason to believe that reason's not reliable. And so it's one of, I think, the most devastating arguments against the materialistic worldview. And it's one that Lewis manages to articulate and defend in about 5 or 6 pages so that most college-educated person would have no trouble reading it. And yet it's still developed today by philosophers like Alvin Plantinga, who've made it very, very rigorous. In my chapter in The Magician's Twin, I argue that Lewis, that's sort of his particular genius, is that he was both an intellectual and an academic elite, but also very good at translating and popularizing ideas, I think, as well as anyone in history, frankly.
If you had to boil it down to one sentence, what would that be?
It would be essentially this. All of our faculties, if Darwinism is true, exist simply because they gave our ancestors a survival advantage. That means that only our behaviors would have been sort of preserved by natural selection. Our beliefs, though, there's thousands of beliefs compatible with any particular behavior, and so it's unlikely if the Darwinian process creates everything, including our reason, that our reason actually connects with reality, that it's actually reliable and gets at truth. That's more than one sentence, but it's a little briefer put.
You write that Lewis's argument on these issues is the accessible midpoint between the metaphysical and the analytic. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Well, a lot of these arguments having to do, say, with a first cause, the argument from an unmoved mover that Aristotle developed in St. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, this argument that if you have things that are moving, you can't just have one thing causing another thing to move, causing another thing to move, and you get an infinite regress. So you need some unmoved mover, and that's the thing we call God. Those are metaphysical arguments that I think are good and valid, but we don't live in a metaphysical age. And so I've encountered this myself. If you try to give somebody the cosmological argument for God's existence or whatever, it's like there's just absolutely no point of access. Lewis, on the other hand, he was familiar with that. He could use the kind of tools of traditional metaphysics, but he never sort of pulled them into a discussion where they'd really alienate the average person. And so when you read him, if you're classically educated, you can recognize his thinking on this is something to people like Thomas Aquinas, but he does it in a way that's just accessible to the ordinary person. And yet he does it in a way that's rigorous enough that the argument, even 60 years later, you read it and it still holds up. And that's a very difficult balance. A lot of people popularize ideas, but they sort of bungle them in the process. Others, especially a lot of academics, they may have some argument that's rigorous, but it's essentially inaccessible to anyone with a specialist. And Lewis occupied the kind of perfect halfway point between those tendencies.
You wrote that philosopher Alvin Plantinga, in his Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism and in his 2011 book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism, basically confirms Lewis's argument that one could not consistently believe both the validity of reasoning and the truth of naturalism. Describe what is meant by this and why human reason is a problem for naturalism.
Well, what Plantinga has done, and people that sort of follow philosophy know, he's a very prominent philosopher. He's a Christian, taught at Notre Dame for many years. He's made this argument very rigorous. The core of it is the same as it was with Lewis. Basically, you say, what are the tools that the Darwinian process has, like in the toolkit? Well, it can preserve organisms that have a survival advantage in the population. Natural selection, you know, you got some water buffalo in a population that run faster than the others, they'll tend to predominate and reproduce and fill the population. That's the kind of power of natural selection. So, in principle, that process could produce anything that can kind of be built one step at a time. But you notice the process is blind. It doesn't act for some thing in the future. Moreover, it also, it just acts on things like behavior. So if our ancestors, when they saw lions, ran away from them, then natural selection would preserve that. But what our ancestors believed when they were running away from it would have made absolutely no difference, as long as it connected with this behavior. And so Plantinga essentially recasts Lewis's argument as a probability argument. He doesn't say it's impossible that a blind, purposeless process could produce reason that accesses reality. He just says it's very unlikely, if our rational faculties came about by Darwinian means, that they're going to be reliable. They're just vanishingly small probability. And so it sort of does the same thing. Naturalism gets hoisted on its own petard. Naturalism's almost always claimed to have been based on reason and science and evidence, and yet if you take it consistently and work it all the way out, it turns out we should have very little reason to think reason is reliable at all.
Why would the fact that people do reach true conclusions by reasoning be better explained by theistic metaphysics than naturalistic metaphysics?
Well, you know, at one level, it's really simple. If we're the result of a blind and purposeless process in laws of chemistry and then natural selection and random variation, you can kind of imagine the types of beings that we would become, but it's unlikely we'd have access to abstract mathematical truths. On the other hand, if we're creatures made in the image of an eternal and rational and knowing God, that just sort of makes sense that we would be made also to have access to reason. And in fact, that's always been the Judeo-Christian understanding of human beings. We're not gods. We're not perfect. We're creatures, but we are made in the image of the Creator, and He's rational, and He's made a rational world, and He's made rational beings that can access the world. That all makes perfect sense. It fits perfectly in the theistic framework. It really doesn't finally make sense in the naturalistic framework. And that's why I think, ultimately, even when naturalism sort of occupies the commanding heights of society and all the elite institutions, it simply does not work intellectually, and that's why I think its days are really numbered.
Why do you think Lewis's views on science and scientism and society are important for us today?
Well, Lewis wrote most of the things that we talk about in The Magician's Twin 60 years ago, but if you read them, it's clear that he tapped into these perennial questions that people in almost every age ask. And so honestly, where you're talking about evolutionary psychology, or have we been evolved so that we want to have lots of kids, or we want to be promiscuous, you know, get all these kind of arguments in the newspaper today. Lewis anticipated these 60 years ago. And so when you read his arguments, it's not like this isn't a historical exercise. We really think that C.S. Lewis has ways of putting things and ideas and arguments that are beneficial in the here and now in specific debates that we have in the present.
Would you say that the modern trend, the cultural trend right now, is that science doesn't need morality?
This is the sort of dilemma, is that science is understood in a certain way, then it excludes categories of morality. In fact, this is this idea called scientism, which is really what Lewis attacked more than anything. Scientism, it doesn't mean science. It's not talking about science and all the good it does. It's talking about a philosophy that says nothing is true or knowable unless it can be discovered or kind of verified by the methods, say, of physics or chemistry. Well, if that's true, then all of our moral knowledge goes out the window, because obviously we don't know that it's wrong to torture children for the fun of it by doing a chemistry experiment. We know it because we have access to the moral law. And so it's important that we defend not just reason, but the capacity of reason to understand not just scientific truths, but also aesthetic and moral truths and things like that. And that's the kind of idea that C.S. Lewis pointed to. It's also the thing that John Paul II and Pope Benedict point to, that we're not just defending reason against its sort of postmodern or scientistic detractors. We're defending a broader understanding of reason that captures science but's not reducible to it.
What do you think Lewis's most important contribution to the modern cultural debate or the modern scientific debate has been?
Well, I honestly think it's that Lewis managed to anticipate kind of all the arguments that we're having. You know, there's this big debate about so-called theistic evolution now, and the question is whether sort of Orthodox Judaism or Christianity is compatible with Orthodox Darwinism, or you pick one or the other, or you create another synthesis. All the terms of the debate that we've developed now, Lewis had already anticipated, and so that's what John West and I and others that contribute to the book sort of flabbergasted about. This current debate, we're right in the middle of it, and yet Lewis has a resource for it. And he actually, in my view, he was on the right side of the issue. So he's a very valuable ally because, of course, he's widely read by hundreds of millions of people.
Dr. Jay Richards, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much, Jay.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. For more information and a video about C.S. Lewis, visit cslewisweb.com. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the Center for Science and Culture. Go to discovery.org, click the Science and Culture tab, then hit the donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.